Thank you for listening to this talk, produced by the Art Gallery of South Australia.
All right. My name is Russell Kelty. I'm the curator of Asian art here at the Art Gallery of South Australia. And welcome to Misty Mountain, Shining Moon, Japanese Landscape Envisioned, which started in on 29th of July last year and was supposed to go to April this year, but actually has been extended into late July. So, good. I'm very excited. Somebody else is excited about that. So there'll be a small changeover in May this year, but a lot of these works will remain on display. And today we're in the room titled Lyrical Landscapes. And as you look around, you may guess that this room is all about the landscape and seasonal flowers, displays of flowers, monthly motifs associated with different times of year and different flourishing of flowers. Now, this all comes at a time in the southern hemisphere when we're moving into winter. But in the northern hemisphere, particularly in Japan, they're moving into full cherry blossom season. And so if you go online, you'll notice that there's actually a blossom tracker, which tracks from the bottom of Japan, Kyushu, all the way up to the top, Hokkaido. And apparently, March 30th is the beginning of cherry blossom season in the most southern parts, and then it'll be tracked all along, all the way to the top, which I think ends roughly in April 30th or May. This is a national preoccupation, which has deep, deep historical roots. And I thought to begin this talk, which we'll be talking about these fantastic scrolls by Suzuki Kitsu, I'd actually begin with an anecdote or my own initiation into this wonderful ritual of floral appreciation in Japan. When I first arrived in Japan when I was about 26, which seems now like an age ago, I was living in Far Eastern Japan in a prefecture known as Izumo Prefecture, which is has some really profoundly important Shinto shrines, but also really remarkably beautiful landscape and seascape. Lovely, lovely snow times, winter, fall, summer, you name it. The whole seasons are expressed beautifully. And I was there when spring rolled around through winter. Some friends of mine said, we have to go to the first viewing of cherry blossoms. You could see in the parks that often had cherry trees particular to those parks, often with no grass, children's play equipment. They didn't particularly look all that spectacular. And they said, no, we have to go to Yozakura, or evening viewing of cherry blossoms. I said, fine, you know. Having not been initiated, I was not so kind of intrigued by it, but my friends seemed interested, so I thought, well, I'll go anyways. And so I was, you know, kind of pulled over to this very boring park in the daytime, which had been festooned with lanterns and all sorts of things. There were people who had put out picnic rugs, were having sake and, you know, seasonal delights. And everybody was sitting beneath these beautiful trees with lights and these tiny blossoms, these tiny pink white blossoms kind of just hovering almost like stars in the trees above them. And I just looked around, and it's one of those moments in life, and we've all had them, where it's just an instantaneous transformation of what you thought you knew and now what you know. And in that moment, I was entered into this ritual appreciation of seasonal flowers. And we in the Western world and Western thinking can appreciate the movement of seasons and changing of flowers. But in Japan, this is a deep-seated hundreds of years, if almost thousands of years, journey where flowers over the seasons are paired with seasonal poetry and then become ensconced in art and are repeated again and again and again. And so I thought I would recite to you one of the earliest known poems about cherry blossoms. And it was created in roughly the 8th century. It would have been written by an aristocrat on a tile found in architectural remains unearthed in like the 1970s around the first capital. So this is all about the aristocracy, about the cultivation of your emotional and aesthetic sensibilities, as well as your ability to write poetry, which writing poetry was like the lingua franca in Japan and East Asia. If you couldn't write poetry, you were nobody. If you could write poetry, then you were somebody. And it goes, "At Naniwa Bay, which is in Osaka, they bloom, these flowers. Emerging from winter now, it is spring, they bloom, these flowers." Very simple. very easy. It's called a waka poem, and it's in a, it's like haiku, but it's a bit longer. It's 5, 7, 5, 7, 7 syllables. And it was meant to express both the beauty of the season, the beauty of the blossoms, but also something more deeply embedded in Japanese psychology. So if you look around, there's a profusion of blossoms, seasonal blossoms, such as blossoms of autumn with the arrival or departure of geese, as well as blossoms throughout the 12 months, four seasons in the back with that beautiful work, as well as blossoms blossoming on glass, blossoming in glass, or as well on lacquer and ceramic. So this idea of flowers permeates Japanese art and culture in a way I don't think it does in the West. It's a bit different from going on a picnic and saying, oh, aren't the roses beautiful and so aren't you. You know, it's deeply, deeply embedded over hundreds and hundreds of years, people thinking about the antecedents to these things as well as their own particular feelings, always riffing off the history. So today, we're going to talk about these fantastic pair of scrolls by an artist known as Suzuki Kitsu. And Suzuki Kitsu in the last 10 or 15 years has come under a bit of a microscope. He was considered a good artist, but not a great artist. But in the last 10 years in Japan and also the West, he has become his work and his life and how important he was to the transition from feudal Japan to modern Japan has come under some wonderful scrutiny, and it's been realized that he's actually was more profound than we all thought he was before. This work was created in the 1850s when he dies in 1858, the same year as Utagawa Hiroshige, which you can see in the next gallery. He dies 10 years before the collapse of the Tokugawa shogunate and essentially the end of the samurai and the birth of modern Japan. And he really lights the way for painters of the future in Japan, of modern painters. And we'll discuss that a little bit as we go through the actual painting itself. His life is intriguing. He was born in downtown Tokyo in 1796, what was known as Edo then. It was the seat of the shogunate, of the Tokugawa shogunate. It was one of the largest cities in the world at about a million inhabitants. Highly literate, 80% literacy. So you want to talk about people reading poetry and books, this was the center. You have to remember that Edo at that time was probably, I think, two times as large as London, a quarter more than Paris, considered the continental, you know, the great cities of the world. All these people packed into these tiny little area in downtown Tokyo. And what's really intriguing is that in the 19th century, during his lifetime, there was what have been called morning glory manias. Two, in fact. You've heard of tulip mania in Amsterdam in the 17th century. Well, this was of similar ilk. People cultivating morning glories, or as they're known in Japanese, asagao, in their gardens. There was temple fairs dedicated to the display of what are known as henka, or strange morning glories. Everybody, it seemed, had a bit of this morning glory mania, and this happened twice in the 19th century in areas that he grew up in and he knew quite well. And so it's not without, it kind of goes without saying that this would have had an influence on him, because the morning glory becomes his motif. And if you look up his name online, you will see a pair of beautiful golden screens, similar to this, with just waves of morning glories all over them. They're considered a national treasure. And so we're very lucky in some ways to have this motif, because this was his go-to motif. Just before we get into his biography, it's important to understand the school out of which he came. There's a school of painting in Japan called the Rinpa School. And Rinpa literally means the school of Ogata Korin. And Ogata Korin was a 17th century painter in downtown Kyoto. And he was not only a painter, but also a designer of ceramics. And it's really his style that encapsulates Japanese aesthetics in a way that can never fully be conveyed. And when you see it, you immediately recognize it. One of the main motifs in his style was flowers of the various seasons depicted in almost like a modern abstract style, very simplistic, but very effective, often on cut gold, just like this. And we see this in these two paintings, this very beautiful botanic rendering of Asagao, morning glory, and then this flat gourd, almost modern in a way. It has no shape. It's just this flat panel of beautiful color. And so he was very much considered the last emanation of this school, the Rinpa school. And I have to say with great delight that I never thought I would actually be presenting a work by a Rinpa master in this gallery. And so this was acquired last year. It's one of the great moments of my life. Very happy about that. So Suzuki Shuetsu was born in Edo in 1796. He was born apparently to, so there's a bit of a dispute about this, but he was born apparently to a dyer of purple from Omi, a near region. And he took up painting when he in around 1813. He started an apprenticeship with an artist known as Sakai Hoetsu. And Hoetsu is very interesting. He was a very wealthy son of a samurai family who was allowed essentially to retire and become a Buddhist monk and take up painting as a full-time activity. Now in Japan, unlike our culture, in Japan, historically, if you wanted to retire and become an artist and not have to worry about getting married or taxes or anything else, you became a Buddhist monk. And especially wealthy people became Buddhist monks and then could take up their lives as artists. And so that's what he did. He was shifted from Edo to Kyoto. And in Kyoto, he discovered the works of Ogata Koren. And the Rinpa school is not a straight line of descent school. So it's not from master, pupil, master, pupil, master, pupil. It's actually what's called the revival school. And so it was born in the 17th century. It was revived again and again until it was revived in Edo with Sakai Hoetsu. And Sakai found Ogata's beautiful paintings, and he created a series of woodblock printed books, which were sent around Japan and inspired others to take up this Rinpa school of design and style. And Suzuki Kitsu was actually part of the process of creating those books. And so he had an almost encyclopedic knowledge of the founder or the most wonderful proponent of Rinpa in these books that were going around Japan called the 100 Greatest Designs of Rinpa, the Rinpa School. So he had this kind of almost in-depth knowledge of something that few people knew so much about. In 1828, Sakai Hoetsu, his master, suddenly dies. And he is not asked to become the head of that school in Edo, but instead his friend Reitan is. Reitan eventually dies, and Suzuki Kitsu marries his wife and takes on the Suzuki name, essentially, that he has now, and starts his own school, moves away from Sakai Hoetsu and really begins his own school. And that's, you know, he runs the school for about 10 years. And then in the 1840s, he divests responsibility, much like Sakai Hoetsu did. He gives it to his son, Shuetsu. And from that point forward, he really becomes the most profound painter. He expresses himself in the most profoundly beautiful ways. And this work from the 1850s is part of that amazing arc before he dies in 1858. Now, how do we know it's from that period? Well, we know by the inscriptions on each of the scrolls as well as the seals. During this period, his kind of, we'll call it liberated, retired period. This is what everybody fantasizes about, retiring and doing whatever they want. Well, he did exactly that. And it's the seal is Seisei. It's, you know, people in Japan, artists would often change their name and their seals on a regular basis. When people die in Japan, their name changes as well. And so this was his last kind of flourish, beautiful, period in his life before he dies. So these were created about 1850 at the height of his powers. He was a master. And what he presents is a very interesting mix of botanical accuracy as well as modern interpretation of Rinpa, which will become, in a sense, provide modern artists with a way forward. And if we look at them closely, and I recommend, without tripping over the plinth and running into them, to look at them closely because they reveal something quite extraordinary. On the right is the Asagao. Now, Asagao in Japan is most intimately attached to summer. When you see an Asagao, you can almost hear the cicadas starting to drone in a Japanese rice field. You can feel the humidity that rises throughout the day and the heat If anybody has been to Japan or Asia during the summer months, it's almost unbearable. The heat and humidity, and Jen is shaking her head. It's you just want to run and hide somewhere under a dark rock. It's so unbelievably hot. And the Asagao is a great emblem or motif of this because it rises during the morning heat and then kind of crumples up during the day when it's so hot. And we see this beautiful leaves and tendrils kind of reaching out into space with almost this twill effect. The Asagao themselves, if you look very closely on the right light, you can see them sparkle, almost as if there's dew kind of on them in the early morning. And the reason for that is that Suzuki Kitsu probably had his lower artists or disciples, grinding up mineral pigments. So this could be, we're actually going to do some tests. This could be lapis, we're not sure, but the mineral and the way that they're ground organically actually creates these various effects of light, which is very novel, you know. Also, if you look at the leaves, they have this beautiful fluidity in them. They almost look like almost real leaves because of what's known as tarashikomi, or this painting in effect. So you paint a bit of paint, fluid paint, and then you continue to add different layers of paint until you get this fluid, almost organic feel. The veins themselves are actually in gold, and it's mounted, the Asagao is climbing up this trellis made out of bamboo. Very simple, but look at the space. There's space, negative space everywhere. There's this beautiful quiet and calm and focus. On the left is the Yugao, or night blossom. So if the Asagao is the morning blossom that comes out during the morning before the heat, the Yugao comes out at night when the heat has subsided and the cool of the evening. And you see this massive gourd here painted in probably malachite, again, ground pigments. And you see this beautiful white blossom just kind of poking its head out at the top. Look at it closely. You see these beautiful lines and movements. And you have to remember that this isn't on paper. This isn't on canvas. This is on silk. And silk is one of those materials that is unbelievably unforgiving. If you make a mistake or your cat runs on the top of it, it's done. That's it. You have to start over again. The moment is lost. Now, when you look at these two motifs, you may think, of course. Suzuki Kitsu grew up in Edo. He hung out. He was around during morning glory mania. This is the reason why this became his motif. But what we need to remember when we're in this room is that everything is much more historically grounded than that. And so to understand the beginnings of the morning glory, we have to reach back into history, in Japanese history, of literature and also art. And the place that we land, of course, is the tale of Genji. Created in 1000 AD by Murasaki Shikibu, a female courtier and poet and writer, it's often perceived as the first modern novel because of the way that it's structured and the time movements and the kind of interior psychological feelings that each of the characters have. And these two motifs appear as chapters in the Tale of Genji. So the Asagao is chapter 20, and the Yugao is chapter 4. And both of them refer to particular women that are associated with Genji during these particular chapters and are actually referenced in poetry and referred to as symbolic of them. Now, the Tale of Genji in our modern times has come under some criticism for being highly sexist and patriarchal. And so I'm not going to go into depth on that. However, I'll let you figure that out by yourself. But what I will say is that the poetry is fascinating in the Tale of Genji. And the verse is fascinating in the Tale of Genji. And so I'll just recite one piece from Yugao. And both of these are very interesting tales about his relationships with the female characters in these. Yugao is very interesting. The story goes that Genji was visiting an old nurse out in the regions, and he came across a beautiful house, a kind of rundown house, with beautiful Yugao, running up along the side of it. And later that night, he was retired to his quarters, and he received a fan with a one single night blossom kind of plucked and put on it. And so it goes, he said this. What was on the fan was a poem by a female who's then named Yu Gao, and she wrote this. At a guess, I see that you may indeed be he. The light silver dew brings to clothe in loveliness a twilight beauty flower. So this, you know, it's always hard to read this poetry because it's very convoluted, but essentially what she's saying is this you, you know, is this you that walked by my house the other day? And you are so beautiful. And Genji was very beautiful. He's often referred to as a playboy. Light silver dew. It's actually Genji means shining light. So light silver dew that clothes the loveliness of she who is the Yu Gao. And that's the name, her name, Princess Yu Gao. So this book is written 1,000 years ago. It's written about 750 years ago before Shuitzu made this painting. But it speaks to the ideas in Rinpa that were often associated with the aristocracy and also ideas of seasonal poetry and flowers and their importance in Japanese culture and how they kind of reverberate through painting, poetry, and literature in many different ways. Now, if you are a woman and you want to read The Tale of Genji, I would recommend that you do. It's a very interesting tale, and you can, you know, cast your eye and poo-poo Genji and all this stuff and still have a wonderful time. It's a wonderful tale. So we get a sense that these paintings are not simply about Shuitzu and his contemporary time, and this is all about me. This is about something deeper and more profound than that. If we move into the 18th century, the Yu Gao or the Asagao takes on a different flavor because that is the time of the haiku poet Basho and others, a particular female poet named Kaga no Chiyo, who's one of the most well-known and renowned poets in Japanese history of haiku. And she writes, Asagao ni tsurube torarete morai mizu, in the mid-1700s. And that roughly translates as, the Asagao has tangled my bucket well, or my well bucket. I will have to search for water elsewhere. And what she's saying is very interesting. As haiku often are, they're very economical, but you can draw many different threads out of them. And this is a very interesting relationship with nature that she is proposing. She's not going to simply tear away the vines of the Asagao so that she can run up the well bucket and get water. She respects the beauty of the Asagao to such an extent that she says, okay, I'll move to another place and get water. So this relationship between man and place and flowers and so forth. Now, when we look at these works by Kitsu, you have to remember that he is, you know, he's creating these at the end of his life, at the end of this great period. And what happens afterwards is, you know, this idea of modern Japan. And Rinpa becomes essentially a historical school, but it still reverberates forward. And so what always strikes me with these is how flat and almost modernistic they appear. If you look at them and then you look at early 20th century painting in the West, in Japan, there is a sense that this, you know, this gives a kind of opportunity for painters to explore a different way of modeling flowers, but also space and flatness and depth and so forth. And you have to remember that Japanese art had a hugely profound effect on the Impressionists, the Post-Impressionists, and on and on. And if you go up into, you know, the Elder Wing, where Tracy and Ella have done a spectacular job up there, you notice when you get to the late 19th, early 20th century, you can see actually a sort of resonance between what's happening in Japan and what will happen in Australia. And just to give you a sense of how important these flowers are, these seeming flowers are so kind of mundane, I want to just leave you with a quote by Ernest Fenollosa. Now, if you don't know who Ernest Fenollosa is, he was one of the first people from America that entered Japan after the collapse of the shogunate in the 1860s. And he also managed to save hundreds of works of Japanese art and bring them to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, which you can view them to now, which is one of the great repositories of Japanese art outside Japan. And he wrote, "It is in this sense that we can call the chief masters of this Korin school, Rinpa, the greatest painters of tree and flower forms that the world has ever seen. With them, these by us somewhat despised subjects rise to the dignity and divinity with which Greek art revealed the human figure. So, a man of such high standing regarded flowers as on par, and the way that they were understood in Japan, as on par with the Greeks and the idea of the human body. That's how profound flowers are in Japan. So, next time you walk by, walking down the street, and you see a morning glory or you asagao, think not that it is a noxious weed, but instead a symbol of beauty, art, literature, and culture. Thank you very much.